طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. We have a full show for you this morning featuring Akron University professor and Middle East scholar Walter Hickson, who has written another well-researched book on the influence of the Israeli lobby and, in particular, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, APAC, on the development of U.S. policy concerning Israel. Professor Hickson is interviewed in this broadcast by Grant Smith of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. It begins with his introduction of Walter Hickson.
Today we're joined by historian and author Walter L. Hickson. He is the author of the 2021 book, Architects of Repression, How Israel and Its Lobby Put Racism, Violence, and Injustice at the Center of U.S. Middle East Policy. We're going to spend time with Walter going through some of the most important questions and drilling down on the question of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee treatment in his book. But first, let's just start off getting a bit of background on Walter. So, Walter, explain a little bit about who you are and how you've come through your career to write what I think is one of the definitive books on the Israel lobby in the United States.
Well, thank you, Grant. Yeah, I didn't begin focused on Israel in the Middle East. I was trained as a Cold War historian and actually spent several months living in Russia before the fall, right at the time of the fall of the USSR. And so most of my early career was focused on the history of the Cold War. And I gained a lot of expertise in that. And the Middle East was really peripheral in my vision. Later in my career, I looked more deeply into it and realized that really I had imbibed a lot of the stereotypes and misperceptions about the so-called Middle East conflict as a sort of ancient enmities type of conflict, a religious type of conflict, endless and complex. And it's really none of those things. It's a much more basic conflict, not that difficult to understand, and clear perceptions of justice and injustice in the conflict. So I was captivated by it, visited Jerusalem and Israel and the occupied territories, and that was eye-opening in 2013. And from that point on, I was really very intensely engaged in researching this particular subject.
So you've written, again, quite a number of histories, including The Myth of American Diplomacy, National Identity, and U.S. Foreign Policy. That was Yale University Press in 2008. You've written American Foreign Relations, A New Diplomatic History, Routledge, 2015. The focus of those books, when you say you kind of followed the narrative, what was it about looking at history that would cause any historian to maybe kind of just accept the dominant narrative?
Well, I think we're learning really more and more, even in present day politics and the role of the internet, how important discourse is, or basic perceptions, frameworks, the way issues and politics are framed and discussed. Really carries tremendous weight with masses of people. Foreign policy, it's always been true that Americans, for example, are much more inclined to know more about their domestic economic situation or domestic economic issues and far less about the world and about foreign policy. So this has always been true. And so in Myth of American Diplomacy, I looked at the myths and misperceptions and basically American exceptionalism, the view that the United States was destined and chosen to lead the world. And I looked at and continued another work to explore the relationship between that perception and U.S. Aggression and militarism overseas. But the same holds true of the Middle East. There are a lot of the discourse and the misperceptions about the Palestine issue have played a persistent and substantial role in how Americans see that conflict.
So looking at some of the main topics of architects of repression, I think it's interesting how you start off and sort of set the scene with Trump's bankruptcy attorney, his daughter Ivanka, son-in-law Jared Kushner, and the Adelsons, Sheldon and Miriam Adelson, all gathered in what looked to be from the video a very elegant ceremony dedicating the newly relocated U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. Just a major, major accomplishment, years in the making by the lobby. So what was significant about that, or so significant about that, that it really was the beginning discussion of this book?
Well, in addition to Jerusalem being the literal center of the conflict, the juxtaposition on that date in May 14th, 2018, not only of the embassy dedication, which, as you've indicated, brought out, well-attired, very wealthy, highly elite, overwhelmingly white establishment figures celebrating this blatant illegal action under international law of relocating the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, which had long been prescribed by the UN and the vast majority of nations, almost all beyond Israel and the United States, and throw in the Marshall Islands. But the juxtaposition with what was happening Gaza, where that same day Israeli troops opened fire indiscriminately, including even killing health workers, first responders, during the so-called Great March of Return, in which Palestinians were making a symbolic march. So the violence against brown-skinned people who'd been denied national existence by this long decades of history of Zionist settler expansion and aggression, and Israeli regional aggression, the juxtaposition that very day of the celebration in Jerusalem, the clinking of the champagne glasses, along with this brutal violence, really struck me and seemed an appropriate way to open the book.
Okay, and you say in later portions of the book, and this really struck me when I first read it, in kind of looking at the reactions to that and other parts of the U.S. and Israel relationship, how that could even possibly happen. But you say that in terms of opposition to that sort of outrage, progressives and radicals haven't always placed or played a very productive role when it comes to understanding or confronting the Israel lobby. You're pretty harshly critical of some of the luminaries and recent books about U.S. Middle East policy. Tell us about progressives and radicals that would normally dive headlong into looking at the role of the lobby that really haven't.
Yeah, it's been a source of frustration for me, and I know, of course, it has been for you as well, that that a lot of these progressive and radical voices are I've been very strong on defending Palestinian rights and on the basic illegality and illegitimacy and injustice of the conflict. But for bizarre reasons that are difficult really to understand and very frustrating to face, they deny the role of the Israel lobby, which is absolutely central to all of this. Going back to the point I discussed earlier about the role of discourse and perceptions and the way issues are framed and the way people are as a result of the way language is used and the way issues are framed, taught to look at a certain issue like the Palestine issue, the lobby plays a tremendously significant role in framing that language and shaping the way Americans view it and view it wrongly, although it's the situation's steadily improving. We can talk about that a little later. But I think it's, you know, it may be as simple as these intellectuals aren't themselves fooled by the lobby, so they don't think it's very important. But that doesn't mean that masses of other people are not shaped by and directed by the language that the lobby puts out and the propaganda that it puts out. And it's also just intellectual arrogance. And frankly, it's a laziness in terms of they haven't studied the issue. So sometimes some progressives and radicals have made the claim, oh, the lobby's not important. Mm-hmm. It's more corporations, which doesn't make much sense. And they haven't looked into the matter. So the people who have looked into the matter, we have, of course, famously, John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt looked into the matter, wrote basically a really straightforward book that was vilified and demonized and even labeled anti-Semitic, which, of course, is a tactic the lobbies resorted to more and more in recent years to try to discredit straightforward and truthful information. But it was a very solid book and yet became massively controversial for no good reason, in part because of these progressives who won't acknowledge the significance and centrality of the Israel lobby.
Okay. Well, yeah, I agree. It is frustrating. And I think there are also some financial perils to not just focusing on sort of acceptable outcomes, which nobody can defend, such as the Palestinian situation. But let's get into the book specifically. What time period does this book cover and why? And you've written another book on the lobby that Cambridge University Press published, 2019, Israel's Armor, the Israel Lobby and the First Generation of the Palestine Conflict. So how do these two books work together? Where does one pick up and where does the other pick up?
Yeah, I when I did get into focusing on the Middle East and took my trip to for a few weeks in Israel and the occupied territories. When I came back, I began working on the study that became Israel's Armor. It's a more formal academic book published with Cambridge, and it ends with the 1967 war and the establishment of the occupation in 1968. So I wanted to take the story further to the present, but I wanted to do it all in one volume with Architects of Repression, and to be more more outwardly, openly critical of this injustice that is just apparent and fact-driven in this history. So I went back, but I spent less time on the early period. Architects of Repression really picks up with World War II. To me, while you can certainly argue that the Israel lobby goes way back to the World War I period and even to the beginning of the Zionist movement at the turn of the century, and that's legitimate to argue that, and certainly there was an active Zionist movement, and in the influence in the Congress was apparent as early as World War I. But to me, the modern Israel lobby really begins with the Biltmore meeting in New York, when the lobby really kicked off, and the drive to recognize a Jewish commonwealth, as it was then referenced, in the Middle East took off and gained growing popularity in the United States. And that's when a certain number of people, Abba Hillel Silver, Stephen Wise, although they disagreed about many things, they agreed on the need to lobby American support, rally American support for this new Jewish commonwealth. And so I look at kind of the World War II period in 1942 as the real kickoff for the Israel lobby. And then, of course, with the actual creation of Israel in 1948, it takes off. So I was able to go back and the papers of Isaiah Leo Kennan at the Center for Jewish History in New York, or the New York Jewish Archives in New York City, Center for Jewish Histories in Cincinnati Archive, I also visited and exploited. But especially Kennan's papers, he was the real workhorse, this former Canadian immigrant from a Central European Jewish immigre family, trained as a journalist, but also a lawyer. And he became, as you well know, the key figure in the early history of the lobby. And his papers were excellent and available in New York. And I exploited them fully in Israel's Armor, but have since taken off with other sources on this book, including APAC archives, and especially the Near East Report publication of APAC.
So let's get into that a little bit. You know, you use the American Israel Public Affairs Committee as a key focus, those papers you mentioned, and you frame it, you know, sequentially by presidential administration, which is a, you know, a fairly standard thing to do in a lot of mainstream histories. But before getting back to that sort of central focus, you know, you mentioned that Israel's Armor was more of a standard sort of academic book. It was certainly published by an academic publisher, Cambridge University Press. Do you feel as though there's any sort of limitation to what you can do with a traditional publisher, academic publisher, in terms of this topic?
Absolutely. And there was pushback even in that pretty straightforward traditional academic press. Cambridge did a nice job with the book, but the editor and the external referees, the way academic book publishing operates is the manuscript will be sent out to experts in the field for their evaluation, to catch any errors, to recommend for or against publication, to discuss how the book will sit with the field, the existing literature. They took exception to my use of the term ethnic cleansing, which Ilan Pape had put in the title of his excellent book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, which is document-driven and evidence-driven. Mm-hmm. And even, much to my surprise, some of the external reviewers and the editor at Cambridge wanted me to temper use of the term settler colonialism, which is really absurd, because settler colonialism has taken off as a major subfield in historical studies in the past 10 years with Lorenzo Veracini and Shura Robinson and many other scholars writing books with settler colonialism in the title.
Right.
But when it comes to Israel-Palestine, everything is policed. And this is something we can get into later that is very disturbing. And that's not only does this whole conflict revolve around the repression of Palestinian rights and injustice in Palestine, it attacks the rights of Americans, including freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And it's affected the academy very greatly. And the lack of critical voices in the academy about Israel and Palestine, for an academic such as myself, I'm now retired, but it's very disturbing. And I think the academy has failed. I think academic publishing has failed. I think journalism has failed. And again, this is why the lobby is so important. important because the dominant discourse in this country has enabled the repression of more critical voices.
Well, I think it is important to note that academic and expert review, you know, peer review and expert review is not something that's limited, certainly, to academic press. And that, of course, Architects of Repression and your forthcoming book have both been reviewed in that way. So it seems as though that problem may be in the rearview mirror for upcoming generations of truly critical scholars. And I hope that is the case. So getting back to the structure of...
Let me just interject quickly, Grant. Yeah. Peer review is really important and really helpful. And I have no problem with peer review at all. And it almost invariably makes books better.
Yeah.
And even in all the cases you mentioned, including Israel's Armor as well, the book got better as a result of peer review. But what happened with that book was that the dominant and misperceptions did creep into some of the evaluation.
Right. Right. And then there's this expectation that the author will have to toe the line, or what happens to the project if the author has evidence-based disagreement with that, or that right. The peer reviewer may not be, just as some of these progressives and radicals we spoke about earlier, don't really know enough to do a valid criticism. What happens then?
Yeah, it's a negotiation, and you end up, at least I ended up, you know, you sneak a few things in, really, that, you know, I wasn't going to give up on the term settler colonialism. It's too important and too central to the analysis. So to suggest
that valuable, that, I mean, it really is one of the most valuable frameworks to have emerged.
So I had to stick with that for my own academic integrity and managed to. So I'm proud of that book, and it's fine. In that regard, and we got most of what I needed into it, but it was striking how that whole system that saga unfolded.
So you organized the book by presidential administration. Why did you do that?
Well, just I think it's pretty much it's organized chronologically, essentially, and obviously the administrations come chronologically. What's striking about it is, you know, history doesn't literally repeat itself. That's a cliche that really isn't borne out. But the same sorts of evolution did occur. And that is that very often, even with Truman, even with Johnson to some extent, and these are some of the most uncritically pro-Israel presidents, but especially with presidents like Eisenhower, like Nixon, like Carter, like Obama, presidents of both parties, there would often be a big talk and determination to confront Israel in the lobby and to demand some changes in this imbalanced, unjust situation that had been allowed to occur. But when they came into office, administration after administration confronted the realities of the power of the lobby, especially in Congress. And essentially, they all, to one degree or another, bowed to it. Bowed before it. And so again, it was a testament. I mean, is the lobby influential? It tames presidents. It directs the Congress. So it's very influential and extremely powerful. And you see this again and again with the determination of a president, a popular president like Eisenhower, a popular president like Obama, and they are utterly unable to make a dent, really, in the power of the lobby, which only grows stronger when it is confronted by executive authority and efforts to make Israel enter into even the most basic compromises in recognition of Palestinian rights and justice in the Middle East.
Okay, so tell us about the Near East Report. What is the significance of it? Who publishes it? What's its role?
Yeah, the Near East Report was one of the more one of the major stories of the lobby is just how successful it's been, and how smart and capable and skilled and adaptable its leadership has been So you can condemn the Israel lobby, and I do condemn the Israel lobby for its machinations and the injustice it promotes. But there's no doubting its skill. The Near East Report is an example of that. So it did a couple of things when it was created by Kennan and his cohorts in the late 1950s. One, it was, as you well know, an important source for generating revenue. And the revenue was then diverted by the State of Israel and the Jewish Agency in New York purchasing copies of the Near East Report, subscriptions, diverting that money to Kennan and to the domestic lobby, and skirting foreign agent registration legislation that went back to the 1930s. So it was extremely successful in that was called out by Fulbright in secret hearings in the early 60s, and some changes were made, but they raised revenue for one. But even more important than that, the Near East Report, which Kennan, with his journalism background, very skillfully edited, had the appearance of straightforward news, but it was very subtly highly propaganda. And moreover, it was geared toward the Congress. So every member of Congress regularly received the Near East Report. He began to write pro-Israel congressmen up in the Near East Report. Other congressmen sought that kind of free, favorable publicity with the Jewish and other communities and became more and more pro-Israel. And it was just a highly effective device for shaping the pro-Israeli views of the United States Congress and a larger foreign policy and Washington wonk, but nationwide community of readers. And its readership grew regularly. And so for the 50s, late 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, the Near East Report, with the internet, it's changed a lot. And there are so many sources of information. But for decades, the Near East Report, which I've gone through pretty systematically for this book, had a profound influence on Congress and on creating this discourse we've been discussing of pro-Israeli propaganda in the United States.
Yeah, I've had the same experience of, in my case, sitting in the Library of Congress, having them bring up stacks and stacks of the Near East Report and paging through them. One of them even had Isaiah Kennan's business card tucked inside.
Oh, really?
Fell out as I was leaving through. But I do think that one of the, you know, things that you can't underestimate is the distribution of the Near East Report. I think Kennan was bragging at one point it was going to everybody listed in Who's Who, the Saturday Evening Post, all sorts of major magazines. And it was, again, this highly edited, expertly crafted news source that was not really visible to the public, but everybody on Capitol Hill was getting it. Everybody in the mainstream media was getting it. But I also think it's important to emphasize the Jewish Agency for Israel was paying Isaiah Kennan quite a lot for putting that newsletter out. It was the funding vehicle for him that allowed him to get money from an Israeli foreign agent and fund his operations. And I think without the Near East Report and the quarterly payments he was getting from this foreign entity, they would have been in real trouble. And of course, it allowed the Senate investigation to see what was really going on and document all of that. But so just to move on a little bit, a basic question always comes up. Does AIPAC speak for or represent everybody who's identifying religiously or culturally as Jewish? Are they like the voice of this segment of America?
Well, they would like to be, but they're not. And one of the most important, stories today is the emergence of more and more Jews willing to criticize Israel, which for a long time was simply taboo in American culture. Your duty as a good Jew was to rally behind Israel and to support Israel. And the propaganda on that was pervasive, and the local Jewish federations reinforced it. So as you well know, the lobby is sprawling and complex, and AIPAC is certainly the centerpiece and the most powerful formal disciplinary and money-raising lobby. That is, it punishes those who vote or talk the way they don't like them to do in Congress, and it supports those who toe the line, the pro-Israel line. AIPAC, as powerful as any lobby in the United States, let alone foreign policy lobby, which is by far the most powerful in all of American history. So AIPAC is the centerpiece, no doubt, but the Conference of Presidents of American Jewish Organizations has always worked closely with AIPAC, these local federations, councils, but they do not speak for the entire Jewish community. And from the very outset, there were a substantial number of non-Zionist Jews who didn't like this idea of a Jewish commonwealth. They wanted Judaism to remain a great and powerful religion and not a country. And some were strongly opposed, like the American Council on Judaism, which remains today. But it's a minority fringe and much vilified and demonized group. But more and more, we see American Jews who have traditionally been much more liberal than many other groups and religions in American history and culture, unable or unwilling to any longer just look the other way while Israel engages in brutal and violent repression. So AIPAC doesn't speak for all Jews, and some Jewish groups. You know, there are critical groups like Americans for Peace Now, J Street. There's limitations to their criticism of Israel. And then further to the left, there are Jewish groups like JVP, which are highly critical, Jewish Voice for Peace, of Israeli policy and support BDS and are fully demanding change. So this is one of the most fascinating and important stories right now, is the ability and the willingness of certain segments of the American Jewish community to speak up and demand change. It's really important, and it's definitely going to something the lobby has to deal with in the future.
So let's circle back to that topic of settler colonialism now, and what legacy do the U.S. and Israel share when it comes to settler colonization, and what sort of explanatory power does that have?
Well, it's a very important framework, settler colonialism. It explains a lot about Israel, and yet there are unique aspects about Israel that differentiate it from other settler societies. So the United States is a settler society. Australia is a settler society. And there are many others going back to ancient history and throughout history. The essence of settler colonialism is the belief on the part of a more modern, developed, and usually white and mostly Anglo-American people that they are superior and indeed destined to occupy a land. And in order to do so, to displace, to basically eliminate to the greatest extent possible, the indigenous population of that land. And so Australia did that with Aborigines, Americans, as I and countless other people have studied, did that with Native Americans. In this country, masses of people were removed from the land, continental wide scope of ethnic cleansing, of elimination of these people. And we see the legacies of this today, whether it's controversies over sports team names or many other aspects. So this is a deeply rooted historic phenomenon. The United States is a settler society. Australia is a settler society. Israel is a settler society. And so what these modernist European Jews sought to do, and Ben-Gurion was very straightforward about this, was to remove as many Arabs, Palestinians as possible, and to replace them with as many Jews as possible. This defines Israeli history. It defines it to this very day. It's going on at this very moment in East Jerusalem, in the settlement now over 700,000 illegal settlers in the illegally occupied Palestinian territories, as well as the Golan Heights. And so it really defines what Israel is, and as it really defines what the United States is. And so this also contributes to the affinity between these two countries, because it's to be expected that the United States sort of understands Israel as a settler society that has dealt with savage people and been forced to remove them from the land to make way for a superior God-chosen people to occupy the land. Now, the two things that do distinguish it are, one, the history of anti-Semitism, which is very real and went on for centuries. Jews were vilified and subjected to pogroms, especially in East Central Europe. And this made the intensity of Zionist settler colonialism that much more intense. They were that much more determined because of the horrors that had preceded and culminated with the Nazi Holocaust. But the other, and I think this is kind of one of the most original things about my book, the other aspect of this that is distinguishes Israel is the belatedness of Israeli settler colonialism. So the United States removed Indians, beginning with Columbus, but mainly in the 19th century. And Australia was settled in that same century. So this is when there was a lot less heightened awareness of racism. Racism was seen as scientific and normal. Some races were seen to be superior to other races. Science allegedly made that the truth in those societies in the 19th century. We know better in the 20th, or we should. And certainly after World War II, with the UN, the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Israel came to birth precisely at the same time as this human rights discourse emerged. And this has made the challenge of justifying Zionism and Zionist oppression that much greater. And that has produced the need for a powerful and effective lobby, which they built and which has carried that struggle despite the rise of human rights discourse. They've been very successful in combating it.
So the U.S. and Israel both share this legacy of settler colonization, and it explains some things about the relationship. Did Israel's founders expect the indigenous people to peacefully acquiesce to a flood of new immigrants after World War II, or did they kind of understand, despite the propaganda, what was going to happen?
Yeah, despite the propaganda, there's no way that the Zionist settlers could not have expected resistance. There was a major Palestinian uprising in the 1930s as amid the Nazi genocide, the Jews began to pour from East Central Europe into Palestine. So they well knew that creation of a Jewish state, partition of the British Mandate of Palestine would create violent resistance. People, after all, are going to fight for their homelands. And this was true throughout the history of settler colonialism, whether it was Australia, the United States, or Palestine. So they knew there would be violence, and they were well equipped with their militias and with terror tactics targeting the British, by including those by future Israeli leaders such as Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, were essentially terrorists against against the British mandate in Palestine. So they were very clear and very determined that there would be this Jewish Commonwealth, as they called it, regardless of the violent repression that would be entailed in displacing Palestinians. And when they got their chance, some 750,000 were driven out in the Nakba of 1948, which enabled the founding of the State of Israel.
Okay, so one of my favorite chapters of Architects of Repression is Chapter 7. And just to kind of drill down even more, what essentially was the job of the Israel lobby in AIPAC? What did they have to do in 2006? And what was going on in terms of Israel's war with Lebanon?
Let's start with the first war with Lebanon in the 1980s, because as you well know, Grant, that was a turning point for the lobby too. Mm-hmm. The war did not go well, and many Israelis were angry about the number of casualties that Israel suffered. And unlike the 1967 so-called Six-Day War, which was a dramatic and clear victory, in this case, the resistance in Lebanon was significant and cost, as I just said, a lot of casualties to the Israelis. Furthermore, there was criticism in the West, and including it was eye-opening. For example, many American Jews began to question their previously unquestioned support for Israel because of the violence of the first Lebanon War. So the point I want to make about that is that the lobby took all this in, and AIPAC realized they had to up their game significantly. So a lot of resources and effort were pumped into AIPAC. They began to be more active in policing the American media and challenging it, especially public television and radio, but also mainstream journalism, and to spend more in attacking politicians that they felt weren't sufficiently supportive of Israel and rewarding those that were supportive of Israel. So that really took off in the 80s and the 90s. The lobby grew stronger and stronger to the point where you ask about in 2006 with yet another war in Lebanon. And again, it doesn't go well. And by this point, Israel essentially is losing in Lebanon and has created its own permanent opposition through its regional and borderland aggression. And there's a long history of Israel's borderland aggression. It's hardly the poor, defenseless, sole democracy that's besieged by all quarters. It is the aggressor in the region and mounted many cross-border attacks into Jordan as well as into Syria, and essentially started and wanted the 1967 June War. So Israel had long been the regional aggressor, and Lebanon had been this particular target. The PLO was driven out in the 80s, and now another war in Lebanon. But at this point, Hezbollah, backed by Iran, but homegrown resistance in Lebanon, defends Lebanon from Israeli aggression. And they dig into the hillsides and prove to be very effective and essentially prevail, really, and force Israel to withdraw. And so the lobby has to deal with more carnage in Lebanon, tens of thousands of people killed by Israeli militarism, and yet not a success story for Israel. So that's the setting amid the war on terror that the United States has declared and is now identifying in the 2000s more and more with Israel as a straightforward military and strategic ally amid that war on terror.
So how does not worrying too much about civilians and Dahiya doctrine figure into all of this? What is that?
Yeah, the Dahiya doctrine is named for basically a Beirut suburb heavily occupied, populated by Shiite Muslims. And of course, in the first invasion, there had been the notorious Sabra and Shatila massacres in Greater Beirut. But the viciousness and the violence in Lebanon in all the interventions, there's another major intervention in 1996 in Lebanon. There's been a notable disdain, and certainly in the Gaza wars that we can talk about as well, for collateral damage for civilian populations. The wars have been very indiscriminate, and the use, and so the Dahiya doctrine was basically a pronouncement by the Israeli military that they just won't bother to make any distinctions between civilian and military targets, that everybody's a legitimate target. And so masses of, you know, elderly people, women, children, non-combatants are killed in these airstrikes and artillery barrages that are unleashed. And Israel is basically unapologetic and says that it will continue this approach. So really it becomes ensconced in military doctrine by this dominant military power in the region. And Israel is by far the dominant military power in the Middle East.
So it seems as though AIPAC got the job done. You have the Bush administration fighting off calls at the UN, even from the EU and world leaders, to have a ceasefire. And Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, saying, well, this is no time for a ceasefire. And so the U.S., at kind of the height of the onslaught for 34 days, enables Israel to continue pounding away. And most Americans kind of swallowed AIPAC's depiction of Israel as being a besieged innocent under terrorist attack, as you write. So AIPAC's job in Congress was to do what, and what sort of results was it getting in Congress to support this attack?
Well, you're right about those perceptions of AIPAC successfully, particularly in the period after 9/11. What 9/11 did was it made a lot of Americans identify with this narrative of Israel as the besieged innocent. A lot of Americans perceived the United States as the besieged innocent in 9/11. And of course, innocent people were killed in 9/11, but the United States was hardly innocent. There were reasons why the United States was targeted, and it had unleashed its own indiscriminate violence in many places, which really created the militant Islamic resistance that finally unleashed 9/11 and grew in so many other countries. But what 9/11 did was made a lot of Americans identify with Israel. This is what Israel had long claimed to be: a besieged innocent surrounded by hostile forces who would destroy it if they possibly could. And by these you know, horrifying attacks in the United States and in Washington and New York and Pennsylvania, Americans could more and more relate to this special ally that Kennedy had proclaimed Israel to be in the early 1960s and AIPAC had nurtured for decades. So amid the war on terror, there's this natural sort of affinity. But at the same time, there is some effort, even by a very pro-Israeli president like George W. Bush, to rein in the excesses of Israeli aggression. But whatever that sort of criticism occurred, or there was any effort to link the massive American funding, which we really haven't talked about, of course, is the essence of what the lobby does, is secures for Israel massive American funding,
right,
to the tune of $150 billion since World War II, far more than any other country in the world has received. This tiny little country of about 9 million people, which is the powerhouse militarily in the Middle East, doesn't need all this American money, which could well go much more effectively to benefit other people in other countries, if not just in the United States itself. But in any case, whenever there's any hint of linking Israeli aggression, brutal violence in Lebanon or Gaza with its behavior or something else we haven't discussed, Israel's utter disdain for the so-called peace process, another fantastic propaganda story for AIPAC is that Israel has long sought peace, but has not been able to get the Palestinians to cooperate. It's just utter nonsense. And the reverse is true. And this has really been established by scholarship at this point, that it's not even questionable that Israel has resolutely opposed the peace process and a settlement that might drive it out of the occupied territories. But to finish this thread, whenever the effort has been made to criticize Israeli aggression or excess militarism or link U.S. funding, this happened to George W. Bush, as it happened to his father. A massive rally was called in Washington. The Jewish organizations, Elie Wiesel spoke, others spoke, claimed that Israel was threatened. Its very existence was under threat. The United States had to stand by Israel. The cliche of cliches that it was threatened to be driven into the sea, which is complete nonsense. So these rallies would be held, congressmen would be called, emailed. AIPAC continually let them know that they would receive support from the lobby, or their opponent would receive support from the lobby, depending on their reaction. So they would mobilize very effectively to rein in the criticism. So AIPAC and the lobby have done this again and again and again over the decades, policed the discourse in Washington, and that permeates throughout the country.
You have been listening to Professor Walter Hickson, interviewed by Grant Smith. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.